the thing that I believe about songwriting and songs is that no song means exactly the same thing to any two people because no people have had exactly the same experience, right? So it's also when a song strikes a resonant chord, there's something universally accessible and resonant about it that bridges to so many different hearts and souls and bodies. And so when I think about, you know, music and ways of bridge building, music is one of the best ways that I can think of.
Hello there. My name is Duncan Autry, and you are listening to Fractal Friends, the podcast where we explore our self-similarity across our diversity. We all have a role to play in the whole, and the purpose of this show is to interview people with interesting perspectives on the world and see what we can all learn from one another. In this episode, I talk with Austin Willacy. Austin is a musician, producer, and mentor. I've known Austin for the last few years through the Thrive Choir of Thrive East Bay, but he's been growing and healing through music and mentoring others through musical expression for decades. And this conversation is an exploration of how creativity can touch and move all of our lives. In this conversation, we talk about the importance of finding your passion and then doing the work of growing into your best self. And with that, we talk about the role of mentorship and developing resilience to vulnerability so that we can keep growing and learning and evolving. We talk about the power of music to connect our minds and our hearts. And we talk about the power of music to help us connect across our differences. We also talk about the importance of slowing down, allowing space for the long, slow thoughts, and creating space for our creativity to shine through. It is a powerful act of healing for the whole world to remove the barriers of shame and fear that hold back our highest creative expression. This episode is a dose of powerful medicine for these times, and I'm sure that it'll move you as much as it moved me. Thank you for listening to Fractal Friends. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it, give it a review, and share it with some friends of yours. Also, come visit fractalfriends.us, where you can get more information about Austin and the things we discuss in this episode. This episode's webpage features an incredible amount of musical content and musicians, songs, and videos. And it'll also show you how to get plugged in with Thrive East Bay. So I've been doing Fractal Friends for nearly 5 years now, and there are over 50 episodes to explore. So I also encourage you to check out the archive at fractalfriends.us, which is now organized by category. I'm also excited to say that it is possible for you to support Fractal Friends. You can make a donation through PayPal, or you can become a patron of Fractal Friends through Patreon, where you could subscribe to make a regular contribution. You can find buttons to make contributions on this episode page and also at fractalfriends.us. One last thing. I want you to know that I'm professionally dedicated to helping the world improve its capacity to communicate across our differences. And aside from this podcast, I have a company called Spoke and Wheel, and we work with teams, companies, organizations, and groups to help them transform their relationships with conflict and with each other. If you know groups or teams that need support to be able to be happily and effectively working together towards their life-affirming purpose, please send them my way. We offer free initial calls at our site, spokeandwheel.co. That's spokeandwheel.co. And now let's go ahead and get on with the show. This episode was recorded in August of the year 2020. Please enjoy this conversation with Austin Willacy. Hey, Austin. Well, thank you so much for being on Fractal Friends. I am glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
This is really great. I know you through Thrive East Bay, and
yes.
I'm sure we'll get around to talking about that some more.
I bet we will.
And I also just been really moved by you and your music and really the passion and dedication that you bring to it. So thank you for that. You know, it's interesting, you know, one of the kind of recurring themes that kind of keeps on coming up as I talk to different musicians, it's like, you know, like, wow, why is music like so powerful? And so I'm sure we'll get into that as well. But I would just love for you just talk a little bit about sort of who you are and sort of what your relationship with music is.
Okay, I can do that. I have been living in the Bay Area for 20 something years at this point, but I was born in Washington, D.C. and grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, a suburb called Shaker Heights. And I am the son of two lawyers. And my brother and sister-in-law are lawyers. I have an aunt and uncle who are lawyers. And I have some cousins who are also lawyers. At the dinner table, when I was growing up, we would talk about all manner of things. And I was definitely encouraged to have an opinion. I was encouraged to ask good questions. I was encouraged to see both sides or as many sides of an issue as I could. And I think that that served me really, really well. Going to college, I studied psychology, which I think was an extension of really trying to see all around and inside things. And I did a lot of music stuff when I was small, took piano lessons, quit by seventh grade, played sax, quit that in ninth grade, and then really didn't do anything musical. And then ended up stumbling into singing because there was a girl that I liked who was the president of the high school choir. And she heard me humming along with a song on TV and said, "You have a high voice. You're a tenor. You have to join the chorus." And I had a crush on her for years. And it had never really worked out. And we didn't, newsflash, we didn't get together. But she did encourage me to sing over and over and over and over again. And so finally I said, "Fine, I'll do it." And she was very excited. And so I joined the choir and was in a pretty small tenor section and was so blown away by this guy that I was sitting next to, a guy named Sean Anderson, who's still making music in Georgia, Atlanta, that by the time it came time to go to college, when I was there, I saw an a cappella group perform, a group called the Dartmouth Airs, and I was floored, and I was like, I have to do that. And so, ironically, going to Dartmouth College was how I got into music, because I was otherwise on track to either be a doctor or a lawyer, which was definitely would have been welcomed by my parents, by my grandparents, by the institution that I went to. And when I was there, I experienced the student body, a lot of it as being pretty liberal. And so I was getting a chance to really like go to a lot of rallies and marches and recognize the interconnectedness of all of them. And there were some really outspoken and well-funded voices that were not necessarily about the same stuff. And so it was an opportunity for me to practice listening and seeing as many sides of an issue as possible then. But what was also happening for me there, as well as making some friends that I still have to this day, is I fell in love with music hard. My freshman year in the a cappella group, the director was amazing, and he could tell that I was just really excited about the music part of it. So like made me a mixtape and said, here's some songs that might be good for you to arrange when you're director of this group someday. And this was a senior who was, dual major in music and medicine, and he's telling me that I'm going to be director of the group. And I was like, wow, I better take this seriously. So I started taking some music theory classes. I got some solos in my group, started being known on campus for that, and then got into bands, and then started two bands my senior year, and started writing like more regularly. I had not played an instrument for, I don't even know, but 7 or 8 years at that point in time, 6 or 7 years. But I started a band called Free Association, and we decided that the second year that we were together, my postgraduate year, that we were going to write music together. And that was how I got into writing. And so a year after that, though I was super passionate about psychology, I had minored in education and was very lovingly mentored by and still am a man named Andrew Garrod, who was grooming me to be a teacher. I feel like there were two significant things that allowed me to pursue music. One, my best friend at the time, a woman named Priscilla, said, "Hey, you're planning on going to be a lawyer." I said, "Yeah," because I had taken the LSAT. She's like, "Okay, well, when you think about that, is that what you want to do with your life?" I was like, "Well, if I didn't want to be a lawyer, I wouldn't be applying to law school." And she said, "Okay, so you didn't answer my question." I said, "Yeah, I did." She said, "No." I said, "Okay, ask the question again. Maybe I missed something." She said, "Do you want to be a lawyer?" And I said, "Right." And I said, "If I didn't want to be a lawyer, I wouldn't be going to law school." And she said, "Right. I asked you a yes or no question and you didn't answer yes or no. So if you were going to be doing what your mom or your dad does that seem like what you want to do with your life?" And I said, "No." Then she said, "Then why the hell would you go to law school and spend $100,000+ on it?" And I didn't have a good answer for her question. And then within 3 days of that, Andrew Garrod, my mentor, who was grooming me to be a teacher, and he was British, says, "Hey, buddy, I've come and seen you perform with the Dartmouth Airs and with both of your bands, that Free Association stuff, Spinache, I think is the name. You know, you come alive in a completely different way when you're on stage making music. Have you ever thought about doing that? And I was totally blown away because here I am at this fancy pants school where my best friend has basically said, you know that you don't want to be a lawyer, don't do that. And then the person who's supposed to be grooming me to be a teacher says, hey, maybe you should do music. And right. And so like here I was recognizing, oh, wait, I'm being seen. And I had choices. I could have said, well, okay, it's nice that you all think this, you know, that, but this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to stay on target. But it really, it rocked me. It rocked me to my core in the best way. And I recognized, okay, being witnessed by two people who I had such deep relationship with, who were challenging where I was heading, gave me the permission that I needed to pursue music. So I moved out to the West Coast. And here got into an a cappella group called the House Jacks that I've been with for a long time. Been mentoring a teen a cappella group called Youth and Arts' Till Dawn that I've been with for 23 years. Started playing guitar. I started on bass for a couple of years and then switched to guitar when I got into the House Jacks because we were touring all the time. And there was it was just super inconvenient to take a bass and I wanted to be writing music and guitar was a little bit better for that for me. And so that kind of formed the musical foundation of what I was doing out here, being in the House Jacks. We got signed to a major label, got dropped by a major label, came out of that okay, started touring internationally, did that for a long time. And I went to something called the Leveraging Privilege for Social Change Jam, which is a program of a nonprofit called YES, spelled like, but not affiliated with the magazine. And that was where I confronted privilege in a completely different way than I had, in that I was carrying this story as like a struggling musician. Like I was making enough money to live, but I was not putting any money away. And I had been socialized to think that like I needed to have X number of dollars in the bank and I needed to have an apartment or a house that looked like this. And I was old enough that I needed to be buying a house and a this and a that and that. It allowed me to recognize, first of all, that because I came from a financially privileged family, that I did have privilege that I hadn't been exploring. You know, privilege of education, relationship, access, and a lot of privileged experiences. It also gave me a chance to recognize a lot of different other types of privilege that there are. And so that was the beginning of a, what is now, I mean, 15 years later, I am, you know, organizing and co-facilitating jams. That's what these programs are called, on behalf of YES. And that work has blossomed into three different types of jams, identity-based jams. And I'm a co-founder of the Black Diaspora Jam. There are thematic jams like education transformation, law transformation. And I'm a co-founder of the Arts for Social Change Jams for YES, which have been happening for the past, I think, 8 years, in 7 or 8 years in the U.S. And then there are two that I co-founded with some friends in India and Turkey who are Turkish and Indian. And that work, that sort of work really taking a look at the interpersonal, the personal and the systemic ways that change happens and self-awareness happens, has been something that I've carried through into my work with Till Dawn, the teen group that I work with. And so when Kyle Lemley, who was in Till Dawn when he was 14 to 18, reached out to me to see if I wanted, to see if I knew anybody who could be a good co-director for the choir, I said, maybe me. Because having been at the beta version of Thrive, like in Shadeen and Joshua's living room at Lake Merritt, I recognized that there was something really, really powerful about convening a community of people around shared intention and shared principles that was also not religious. And so it seemed like a really perfect way to be a part of something that was a musical extension of that vision and also was local. And so much of my work, my music work, had me traveling places that were far from home. So that's a bit about where I have come from to who I am now. And I've been talking a while, so I want to pause.
This is great. I love hearing basically this like short life story. You know, you touched on all the themes that I wanted to talk with you today. So we'll just spend the rest of the time unpacking what you've said so far, basically. So I think the first thread that I want to pick up is like this moment of Andrew Garrod, you know, saying that this is where you came alive, right? And it's interesting when you're looking at law and you're like, this is what I want to do, you know, like I have, you can have a great rational explanation of that. And like education, mm-hmm. you know, is obviously like part of you. You love teaching and sharing and inspiring and so forth. So, but then there's something about like, this is some place where you came alive. And I think that just even the wisdom of like, where do you come alive in life? Like noticing that is seems like such an important piece. Do you have a sense of like how you came alive in those moments? Like, couldn't, is there, or why, or like, you know, what's happening there?
Yeah, really beautiful question. Thank you for the question. And I think that there are at least a couple things that contribute to it. One, there is a Stanford study that was done by a woman named Carol Dweck. And she was working with, I think it was fourth graders, and I think it was in New York City schools, if I remember correctly. And she gave sort of like a puzzles type test, the same test to, you know, the whole 400 students or so that were in the study. After the test was over, each student would come up to the desk. And when she was handing the tests back, and she said to half of them, great job, you're really smart. And then to the other half, great job, you must have worked really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is when they were given the opportunity to take another test, those who were told they were smart overwhelmingly wanted to take a test that was at the same difficulty level or lower. And those who had been told that they worked hard and were given, because all of them were told great job, the ones who were told that they had, they must have worked really hard, wanted to take harder tests.
Mm.
And what happens over the course of this study, just like, you know, for the sake of staying on target and on task and to the point, is that at the end, the same, you know, 400 students were given a test that was at the same level of difficulty as the first one that they took. And the students who were told that they must have worked really hard performed significantly better. And those who were told that they were smart performed significantly worse. And the data from that suggests that people who are told they are smart feel the need to protect that intelligence. Because if I say, if I'm told that I'm intelligent, as soon as I say one stupid thing or I make some prediction that's completely off, my perception and others' perception of my intelligence could just be gone. But you can never take away the work that I did.
Mm.
Right? And if you think about the Malcolm Gladwell, like 10,000 hours of practice to mastery, like if I've logged 17,000 hours, nobody can take that away from me.
Oh, wow.
Doing whatever it is. Right. So when I then think of music for myself, nobody made me sing. I chose to. And so when a year and a half after I started singing, I got into an a cappella group that a whole bunch of people didn't get into. I was proud of myself because I had worked for it. I was self-taught.
Mm-hmm.
And when after 2 years of being in the group, through the work that I had done, like saying, ooh, I need to learn these skills so that I will be able to direct this group. I need to learn how to range. I need to understand like what an a cappella group is trying to do. That was recognition of the work that I had done to be ready for, you know. And so I think that the combination of the fact that music is something that lights me up from inside. And I also believe that it's something that doesn't speak to the brain first, at least, right? It's like a soul to soul, heart to heart, body to body thing. Whereas I was used to like being witty or quick and, you know, all these things and being trained to analyze things very well. It felt so different to be sharing joy, grief, expressing challenge, pain, whatever it was, something being super playful and joyous through song. And so I think that the fact that it was a body-based feeling as opposed to like a head-based thinking was a big part of it. And I also think that there was something very attractive to me about having the opportunity to do something that I had been doing my own work towards for years.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I mean, I'm really interested in that study, and I appreciate it because it's there's something about earning something and just knowing that you worked hard for it, and that, you know, and that that's the things that we want to be good at. If we just like sort of practice and keep on doing them for a while, like this is going to be a significant contribution. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about if I just want to just like dream as far as I want, like into the future, you know, like I tend to think about like 10 years out, like I'm just like, let's just basically imagine whatever I want, because it's hard to see beyond that. But it's like, wait, if I just like start today, just start working on this thing, there's not really anything that's going to get in the way of me being able to accomplish any dreams that I have. And so there's something about like that persistence. But then it's also, I think this other aspect that's here is like, and I care about it, like I actually care about it enough to keep working at it, right?
Absolutely.
Like, you know, like, sure, you could have been a great lawyer if you like worked at it really hard. And I think that there's, in certain ways, you know, like those values that you like learned from your parents, like of like having your own opinion, but then also being a good listener and paying attention to all sides of an issue, like that's obviously served you. You've logged your 10,000 hours on that one too, but just not necessarily in a courtroom, you know?
Exactly.
I think it's also interesting, though, to notice like how you were like, you know, you were singing and you like tried these different instruments and you like picked it up and then stopped and then you came back to it. I think that that happens to a lot of folks. I mean, I can remember in my life, I think I was in like the band and the first instrument I played was the flute. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't think that was cool as a boy playing the flute. So I played the drums, and then it was interesting. There was like in a car accident and then like my drums got smashed and I didn't like go back to doing that ever again, you know? And there was like a moment where I was like, love singing. I was like in a little honor choir when I think I was like in first or second grade or something. I was a soprano, you know, at that age. And then I was like, got really embarrassed once about, actually it was interesting. Someone had told my choir director that I like was singing a lot and like was invited to like, it's like, pulled out of class to like go sing alone in front of the choir director to this like song that I had made up. And I was really afraid of the moment. And I might've been like the last time I sang for like 2 decades, you know? And it's like so interesting to like, you know, just of course, just like with teachers and mentorship, you know, how one pulls someone forward or back. But lately I've learned that like, wow, this lights me up. I want to do that. And it's been really helpful in my life lately with my business partner or with colleagues to have someone say like, Duncan, I see you just totally change when you started talking about this or that, you know? And then I'm like, okay, those are the things that I need to be doing more in my life. Right. That's where I want to be investing that energy
into.
So if something moves you, pay attention to that. And that's a good place also to then do some of that work, even if you don't have just like that natural smartness, you know, because that actually apparently, according to Carol Carol Dweck's research is not, you know, it's not actually what you need, because if you think you just have a natural thing, you might just be defensive of it and be, you know, so this is great. So another thing that I noticed in your story earlier was about like this thing about like music bringing people together. You know, and you were talking about how you were exposed to people from like different views, different ways of thinking, but you all gathered around the music. And that was like a common point. I think that that's like a really powerful tool that music has as being this like unifying tool, you know, across differences. And it's like, wow, I care about this. You care about this. Wow, you really think different than me. Your life experience is different than me. That's interesting. So I'm curious, like, some of your thoughts on just, like, music as, like, this bridge builder, either your experience or any reflections you have on that.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that the arts in general are bridge builders. And part of that is that art is not generally supposed to hit me in the head, right? It's supposed to hit me in the body, right? Music is hopefully moving my body and my soul. And different types of art can sort of challenge thought, the way that I think about things, challenge the assumptions that I'm carrying into something. And so music, I think just by virtue of the fact that it often has text that's associated with it, that's part of it, but that text is not just a line or a paragraph in an article that I'm reading, you know, that I'm confronting with all of the frames that I have adopted in terms of how I see the world. There's also a feel to it. There's the major, minor, happy, sad. There's the groove and all of the aspects of arrangement that are also recontextualizing what that text is. So there's no way for me to just hear the words. So I think that at the most basic level, music is a bridge between my mind and my heart. Music with lyrics, right?
Yeah.
And then even for, and I mean, I listen to a fair amount of music in languages that I don't speak and can still feel. And that is because the person who is expressing, the persons who are expressing an emotion or a complex series of emotions. And maybe that complex series of emotions are also carrying thoughts. And maybe I can follow what the thoughts are, even though I don't know the language, or maybe I can't.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing that I believe about songwriting and songs is that no song means exactly the same thing to any two people because no people have had exactly the same experience, right? So it's also when a song strikes a resonant chord, there's something universally accessible and resonant about it that bridges to so many different hearts and souls and bodies. And so when I think about, you know, music and ways of bridge building, music is one of the best ways that I can think of. Particularly if even on Zoom, like I try to do sing-alongs and like teach people a part and have them sing with me with their mics, you know, their mics muted so that they can be a part of taking that music into their body and like trying that on in their own voices too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate that because like that music is, it's like a bridge between people, in part because it's like this bridge between the mind and the body or the mind and the soul.
Yep.
And I also love that part about listening to music in other languages and, you know, like you can feel it because, you know, that added layer of melody and harmony, like on top of these words is also conveying somehow, it seems like just magic to me, like mm-hmm. that, like what is actually being felt there. I actually really love like having a song that I just like know what it's about and then eventually like going and like doing the research and figuring mm-hmm. out, you know, like what is it actually about. And I think what actually is interesting is that what I was surprised by when I do that is that it's a poetic version of that thing as opposed to just like the very literal like description of feelings, which is part of the magic of good lyrics too, is that it's
right.
It's not, you know, like I feel love, I feel greatness, I, you know it's usually a little more subtle than that.
Yes. One of the things that I quickly want to share, like mm-hmm. when I first started writing songs, it was right after leaving Hanover. And I had spent my whole life being trained to analyze, right? Compare and contrast, you know, legitimize this or tear it apart. And what I recognized is that my lyric writing was very essay-like initially. And I was like, nobody, including me, wants to hear a song that's written this way. So I spent, like, I had a temp job in Berkeley, and I spent months, like, every day on my lunch break going to, like, Berkeley campus and sitting on a hill somewhere trying to, like, strip the analysis out of my writing, learning to write again so that there was space for other people to see themselves in it and so that I wasn't trying to prove a point, but more like telling a story or painting a picture by mosaic.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Painting a picture by mosaic, that's really nice.
Thanks.
Somewhat just a little digression here. I was once, I was on a school trip. I was in Spain and we were in this church and we were all standing around looking at this mosaic as like beautifully incredible detailed mosaic. And this person next to us is like, whoa, you know, it looks like someone put each of those tiles there one by one. And we're like, yeah, that's why we're all standing and staring at it right now. Yes, that is real. And that is amazing. It's so amazing that you can barely even believe it's possible. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about, which is, I love the story about how you were Until Dawn and that Kyle Lemley was one of your youth mm-hmm. singers and then later is inviting you to be a co-director of the Thrive Choir. And mm-hmm. I think I mention Thrive East Bay all the time on this podcast, but I don't know how much people would actually know what it is. And I'll say something about Thrive East Bay and then you can tell us a little bit about the choir. So Thrive East Bay is this purpose-driven community. It's been around for 5 years now, and it's kind of, the structure of it is kind of explicitly borrowing the model of like church or temple or mosque or some sort of spiritual community, but it's secular. It doesn't have any religious connections, though it definitely does move the spirit. And it's a way for people to come together in community. And there's like amazing speakers mm-hmm. and a choir and people, you know, small groups that form around it. And now that it's virtual, by the way, people can totally come join Thrive East Bay and come participate, wherever you're listening yep. to this. And its guiding principles are about like individual thriving, about building strong community. It's about taking action with love and about systemic change. So we really are about like building a stronger community and having an impact on the world. And one of the things that's most famous about it is its amazing, amazing choir.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that the other thing that I experience about Thrive is that it is a community of shared learning and practice, and that one of the ways that I differentiate between sympathy and empathy and compassion is that sympathy is recognition that somebody else might be going through something. Empathy is relating that to my own experience enough that I can feel that in my body to some degree. And then compassion is working to right the wrong, alleviate the imbalance. And one of the things that I love about Thrive is that it is a community that not just says that it is striving towards compassion, but is practicing that ongoingly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's a really beautiful and powerful thing about Thrive.
Yeah, I'll just even add there. And also like the theme of beloved community is like a really powerful thing. Like Thrive is actively embodying and cultivating beloved community in the sense mm-hmm. of just like a real opportunity to coming together of people across all our differences and life paths and races, ethnicities, religions, and just like a place to sit, like we're doing the work to make sure that we can actually be in relationship with each other.
Exactly.
And that's of course where that sympathy, empathy, and compassion comes in. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, tell us about the choir.
Sure. The choir was born out of two things. One, Kyle Lemley's desire as a young Jewish man to write gospel music, but gospel music that was non-denominational and that was love songs, healing songs that were exalting Mother Earth, human possibility in that context. And having known Kyle since he was 13, you know, and had 4 years of singing with him when he was in Till Dawn, and then my a cappella group went to Brown and performed with his a cappella group, and I had seen how much he had grown doing his own work as a singer. And the Thrive Choir started out really small and grew bit by bit by bit, and comprises people who live in the Bay Area, primarily Oakland, who are artivists, you know, artist activists, who are educators, people who represent a number of different social identities, races, classes, religions, and are all deeply passionate about the principles that are at the core of Thrive.
Yeah.
And so we, over the past 5 years, have a total repertoire of like roughly 50 songs. Over the course of the past couple of years or so, we've been moving increasingly in the direction of showcasing our original music. And there are a number of people in the choir who write amazing music. And one of the things that we've been doing during this quarantine is some songwriting groups. So we're getting to share songs with each other when they're brand new or, you know, half-baked, and giving each other loving feedback about them. And in some cases saying, oh my God, we have to do this, you know. And so that's been a really, really beautiful way of using what Zoom is good for in the breakout rooms to create intimate spaces for that, since we can't actually sing together. Because if anybody's listening who's tried to sing with anybody else on Zoom, y'all know it's a disaster.
Yeah, it's just that time lag just does not work out. Everyone has to be in sync.
Yes. So we perform at the Thrive events. Historically, we have, because obviously the Thrive events are virtual now. A number of us have been featured at some of the Thrive Sunday virtual events, individually or in duets. We perform at a lot of different community events. We have also performed with like Rising Appalachia and Ma Muse and Climbing Poetry, who are sheroes of ours. And we have performed with and for Bernie Sanders' campaign a couple times, and also at Lightning in a Bottle, which for those of you who are aware, it's a huge music festival that typically happens in May on the West Coast. This year, it was kind of paused like so many other things. And so we've been really growing pretty rapidly in terms of the opportunities that are finding us, and really, really grateful for that. And particularly because as people who are working so hard in our communities and in the work that we're doing, to have that met, the artistic offerings, the musical offerings that comes through met with so much love feels amazing.
Yeah, support. It's really great. And for anyone who's listened to this podcast a lot, I've featured some of their music over the years, but I'll make sure that at fractalfriends.us that people can find all sorts of, links and stuff like that, so you can find all this Thrive music and, with this episode. And one of the things we'll put there is the new music video that you all just recorded.
Mm.
And Thrive just did a fundraising campaign for its new EP and raised tons of money and be able to just make sure that all these artivists and artists and videographers are getting like paid like really good to be able to make this amazing video. And when is that album going to be coming out, by the way?
Well, I am producing the recording, and we are definitely much closer to done than to the beginning of it. We're now in the level of like getting some additional overdubs in terms of vocals, percussion, cello, and then some amazing ambient guitar. I want to shout out the instrumentalists in the Thrive Choir. Kelly Natoto, who plays hand drums and has been playing African percussion basically his whole life. Jordi Rosales, who plays cello. Z Greer, who plays both rhythm and textural guitar. And Jason Reeder, who plays bass. And so we're doing some overdubs with these people. And the idea is that we'll be done sometime this fall. We haven't publicized a date, but my hope is that we'll be able to get it out to the world sometime before Thanksgiving.
Awesome.
That's my hope.
Yeah. And so whenever this episode comes out, maybe we'll sync it up. We'll see how that goes. But
amazing.
Yeah, that's great. So, we were talking about just like doing, this music, production and sharing in this Zoom space in this quarantine. And I know that in a certain way, people not being able to just get together and jam with each other is, I imagine, a real challenge for making music. But I know that like you have found some cool ways to overcome that in a ways. And it's also has you connecting with musicians like all the way around the world as well. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been up to lately?
Sure. So on an explicitly music front, I have some co-writer friends that I've been collaborating with for up to 3 years. I have a friend named Sonia who lives in Bratislava, which is in Slovakia. And we have been collaborating via Skype or Facebook video for a few years. I have a friend who's named Patricia Bahia, and she's based in Los Angeles. And we met very briefly in Berkeley, but then connected a couple years later at the Positive Music Awards, where we both won awards, and decided, inspired by the same line of a Rumi poem, that we wanted to write a song together. And so we did, and that's actually a song that the Thrive Choir does. It's called We Are One Love, and it's going to be on the EP. And then I have another friend named Kaylee Rose, also in Los Angeles, and we have been co-writing. I think we've written like three and a half songs via Facebook video. I have a friend in Australia named Ben Drysdale. We're halfway in to a song we've been working on. And so what I've been doing is just trying to use Zoom or Zoom-like formats for what it's really good for. And it's very easy for me to be in Pro Tools and like building a beat, building a track real time while the other person I'm on is vibing on something else. And so that there's like a co-created aspect, and that it's in real life, real time. It's just not in person.
Right. Yeah.
And that's the motto for right now, right? Like IRL in real life, IRT in real time, but not in person.
Totally. Yeah, it's cool. You know, I always think when I first heard about you like making these songs across distances, I thought about a postal service. You know, I think that they like made their album, like their first album together, where they were actually mailing by each track back and forth between each other.
Yep.
It was like Zoom is like a way upgrade compared to that. So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and Steely Dan apparently did that too. Like they would be sending, and this was when the only way to record was on like heavy magnetic tape.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd be sending these massive boxes of tape, like from Los Angeles to New York to get the right bass player or drummer to play or sing on this thing and then sending them back.
That's amazing. Well, I wonder if you'd be willing to share one of those songs that you wrote during this quarantine.
Yeah, I would love to. I would love to. The one that I would like to share is a song that I wrote with my friend Patricia Bahia. Incidentally, before I say this, I should say that We Are One Love has been nominated for a Peace Song Award.
Wow.
And I wrote that one with Patricia. And then there's actually another song that I wrote with Patricia and Kaylee that is called Man Up. And that is also nominated for a Peace Song Award in a different category.
Oh, that's awesome.
This one we wrote, Patricia and I, just sort of recognizing how challenging this time is just in general. And at the same time, how there's a beauty to what has and a uniqueness to the opportunities and perspectives that have unfolded during this time. And so we wanted to write something that was just tapping into the acknowledgement of the struggle and a deep belief that there will be light on the other side of it. So it's called The Light at the End of the Tunnel, parenthetical title, Better Days Are Gonna Come, longest title of any song that I've ever written. And I've been living in a world of hurt. Do remember beauty blooms from the dirt. But I know better days gonna come. And when darkness rises up, give me the strength I need to trust and know that the light, the end of the tunnel, gonna shine on me. Oh, shine on. Oh, shine on me. Oh, shine on. Shine on me. 'Cause I know the light, the end of the tunnel, gonna shine on me. And I've been face down in the dust, and all my tears have turned to mud. But I know better days gonna come. And when darkness rises up, give me the strength I need to trust and know that the light, the end of the tunnel, gonna shine on me. Whoa, shine on. Gonna shine on me. I know the light, the end of the tunnel, gonna shine on me. The better days are gonna come. Oh, better days are gonna come. Oh, bad days are gonna come. Oh, bad days
are gonna come. Better days are gonna come. Better days are gonna come. Oh, yes, they will. 'Cause I know the light at the end of the tunnel. I know the light at the end of the tunnel. I know the light at the end of the tunnel. Gonna shine on me.
Yay. Oh, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
This is such a beautiful example of, you know, what we were talking about music before, just that these, one, how you can feel the lyrics in the music, you know, and in the voice and in the tone and the quality of it. You know, it has that flavor of like of longing and hope and conviction, you know, like this will happen, and ouch, you know, like need it. We need it to happen. But then I also love just the universality of it. Like that song is very like super appropriate in these quarantine times, as you said, like, but also like you could just, that's going to be true. That song will resonate with anyone who's having a hard time anytime. And that's another cool thing about music is that it's like infinitely replicable. You know, someone can be having like a, you know, heartbreak, you know, 20 years from now, and they could play that song and be like, this is really helping me with my breakup.
Well, thank you, Duncan. That is definitely our hope for it. That it's something that speaks to what's happening right now and also, you know, speaks to the power of hope.
Yeah.
Howard Zinn has a really beautiful quote about that. He says something like, to be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. You know, that in human history, there is a history of cruelty, yes, but also compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. So it's perhaps the most important time to be hopeful right now.
Yeah. It's really important because one of the like the themes, especially like in this like season of Fractal Friends, is, you know, like facing reality, you know, like things are real hard right now. And there's a lot, plenty of things to be afraid about. But we are totally the ones that get to make the changes in this world. And we, like, we not get to, we're the only ones that we have to, you know, it's like, what are the, we are the ones, whatever we are chart, you know, the path that we chart right now is it. And like setting our sights on like, we know that this can be better and we want it to be better and we're going to make it be better.
Yes.
Is like really important. Hey, Fractal Friends, I'm going to jump in here with a quick important message. I don't know if you've noticed, but democracy is struggling these days. There's pretty much a global consensus that things are not working out very well. And in the United States, things have become particularly contentious lately. The divisions and tensions are not just happening across the political divide. There are also deep conflicts that are happening amongst people who are trying to work for the same cause. It does not have to be this way. Sure, it can be expected for people to disagree about important political issues, but being held back by painful and divisive conflict is totally optional. And in my opinion, we should not put up with this division anymore. The skills and tools to communicate across our differences and turn a diversity of opinions into an engine of learning and growth are not only available, they are effective and they are teachable. As an extension of my work at Spoken Wheel, I am also part of a project of Mediators Beyond Borders International that we call the DPACE Initiative. DPACE stands for Democracy, Politics, and Conflict Engagement. We work with political groups, social change movements, and communities that are struggling with social issues, and we help them engage with conflict more effectively. We offer skill building and direct support like facilitation and mediation. We have also created a conflict literacy framework with tons of information about how you can navigate conflict with both skill and grace. You can find information about the DPACE Initiative and the conflict literacy framework at dpaceinitiative.org. That's DPACE initiative.org. If you're ready to stop worrying about conflict and get back to being an engine of change, come check us out. You can send an email to dpace@mediatorsbeyondborders.org, or you can schedule a call with me at duncanautry.com. Thanks for listening, and now let's get back to the show. It makes me think a bit about just like, you know, I heard you say once that, you know, it, like, as you said earlier, that it's like lyrics, you know, plus like melody, harmony, like makes something that's more than just those lyrics. Mm-hmm. And then when we were talking, preparing for this conversation, we talked about how like, and then you like add a movement into it. And all of a sudden you have like even the more powerful thing, because there's a way that infusing music with inspiring action is like really important.
Yeah, and we're, as I think, as a world, going slower enough that everything gets in, like it lands more, right? Like if normally pre-COVID normal was like going 60 miles an hour, now we're doing like 20, and there are different things that we actually have time to see.
Yeah.
There are different things that I have time to see. There are different things that I have time to focus my energy and attention on. And when something massive happens that maybe I was going too fast to let in as fully, like, oh, that sucks, but it's tragic, but like, you know, got to get onto the next thing. There are fewer next things to get onto. And I also feel like the recognition of our vulnerability and mortality that has been brought on by this trickster virus has me and has everyone that I've talked to just aware of the fact that we are more interconnected than we ever thought before as a world. That a choice that I make about how to protect myself is a choice about how to protect other people too. And so I think it's like this context that allows the arts, that allows music to get deeper into my soul. Maybe I'm singing it from a deeper place in my soul. And it allows it to be heard, I think, more deeply too.
You know, I was reading an article from Kazu Haga recently about how...
Love Kazu.
Kazu's the best.
Yes.
Actually, like, I kicked off this like season three by like re-releasing one, like an old interview I did with him. And it was so crazy because it was like 2-3 years ago, and he's, you know, just talking about racial uprisings and nonviolent protests. And I'm just like, wow, this is, you know, and like the state of the country and the world. And it's like, wow, this is timeless, you know, unfortunately or fortunately enough. But so Kazu was talking about how like we're experiencing, you know, in a way we're like experiencing like collective trauma right now in a way that we haven't had before. In this part where like we're facing death, we're facing like racism, we're dealing with like generational issues as well as like personal issues, and we're seeing images that are really intense. And so I just feel like, you know, just like paying attention to what's happening there. And so, and then just adding that onto what you were just saying about how like, you know, like in this slowing down, and it's like really cool actually, just like this way that like different businesses are just like, you know what, we're just gonna like be a little slower with things. You know, it's like, and we're going to be okay. You know, like things are just like, everyone just, that slowing down allows us to absorb more information. And so it allows us to absorb more trauma and scary and intensity, which in a certain way is useful for us to be actually paying attention to what's going on. And it allows us to like also absorb more inspiration. And I suppose there's also this layer of like getting more in tune with ourself. Like I find myself listening to my own self more. Like just last weekend, I was like, you know what? There's all these peaches right now. I'm going to make a peach pie. And I like learned how to make pie, and I made peach pie for myself, you know? And it was like, wow, I had to have the time of a whole Saturday afternoon to be able to do that. Otherwise, I don't know if I would have heard the voice asking for pie or had the time to make the pie. And it was delicious and wonderful, you know? Right. But yeah, just like slowing down is like really important. And I think we all have this really interesting choice is if whatever normal looks like when we return, I'm like, do we want to like go back to that hustle like we were before?
Exactly. When I hear people saying, you know, oh, I can't wait to go back to normal. And I just ask the question, like, is normal, like, is that what you actually want?
Right.
Or do you want to not be in quarantine? You know, like, there's a huge difference between normal, which was at some levels being too overstimulated to actually recognize the level of suffering and vulnerability that there was.
Exactly.
Like, is that what I want to go back to? No, I don't actually. I don't think that that's in service of me and most of the planet. And, you know, by most of the planet, I mean all life forms.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not trying to go back to that.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things I heard, for example, like in Alaska, you know, this place where they've been recording like these whale sounds for years and years, right? But there's like by this port where there's like these cruise ships. And so like there's cruise ships, these massive motors are just like constantly like in the water. And so they were like, oh my gosh, wait, there's no cruise ships right now. We have to get there and get this recording stuff in the water. And they're like finding out about how these whales are communicating in like better than they ever have in history, but also like they're changing their habits. You know, imagine something that's like based off of like sonar having to deal with this like, you know, sound all the time. And it's like, oh, wow. Or, you know, there's like that city in India that like hadn't had a view of the Himalayas for the last like 30 years. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh my God, what is this? We have the most beautiful city in the world. And like, we never knew that because there's not all this traffic. And, you know, I was just thinking about like someone going back to like, they're like, 2-hour commute to San Francisco from like the suburbs or something, and it's like I might not want to do that again. Wait, because were we doing fine just doing the remote work, you know? Like, and it'll be really nice to be in human contact again and more readily.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, you know, what else are you like paying attention to in these times? Like, what's like, what are some of the things that are up for you? I really, by the way, really appreciated your reflections on like, on, you know, privilege earlier and how that like impacted you and changed you. And, you know, that's obviously like an up theme these days as well.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I'm also tracking is, and it's like, I guess, well, really kind of an extension of the privilege piece, is that I am a part of some groups of men or being asked to support groups of men who are looking to do some healing amongst themselves. And also in service of creating safer spaces for women. And it feels beautiful to see that it is happening. It's also something that I've been, I'm on a team to co-found the first men's jam, having done a lot of years where at the North America jam, we're exploring, you know, race, class, power, and privilege. We're also taking a deep dive into gender. And there's just been so much richness in what's come up that we decided that we really wanted to create a whole jam as an opportunity for men to come together and like do some healing, some celebration, you know, some grief, and some visioning. And I'm getting reached out to in a way that feels really good to be a part of and or support groups of men who are doing that. So I'm aware of that.
That's super important work.
I am aware now more than recently also how important creativity is at this time, and that if the typical path to education and what to do with an education has led us to where we are, then it seems like challenging at least some of that and reimagining, re-envisioning, redesigning, recreating it to some extent makes a lot of sense to aim us at where we're trying to be. So with the young people that I mentor and really wherever I can, I'm trying to support people in making space for their own creativity because it's so easily socialized out of me, out of we. And there's an amazing quote from Brené Brown who I just love.
Yeah, she's great.
And she speaks about how unexpressed creativity isn't neutral. And I've seen it shown up with different friends in my life. And she says, I used to believe, before I did the research for the gifts of imperfection, that there were creative people and there were non-creative people. And now I absolutely understand personally and professionally from the data that there are no such thing as non-creative people. There are just people who use their creativity and people who don't. And unused creativity is not benign. For the people who really struggle because they don't think of themselves as creative, there's a lot of shame around creativity. People don't think of themselves as creative. They think creativity is self-indulgent. They don't think it is productive enough. They don't understand what it means. It was shut down in them as children. For those folks, when I say unused creativity is not benign, what I really mean is it metastasizes into resentment, grief, heartbreak.
Mm.
People sit on that creativity or they deny it and it festers, right? And so she shares that, and she's been doing shame research for 13 years, she found that 85% of the people who she interviewed remembered an event in school that was so shaming that it changed how they thought of themselves for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Half of that group of people, half of the 85%, experienced those shame wounds around creativity.
Yeah.
So she says, you know, 50% of those people have art scars, creativity scars.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, and I've seen that shown up like at a high school reunion, reconnected with a friend who'd been working at this place and she was up for promotion and she was really psyched about it. And I followed up with her like a couple weeks later and she's like, I'm not going to get it. And I said, well, how do you know? She says, well, because I have to create a project and I'm not creative. And I was like, oh my God, like there it is.
Right.
Right. This is a woman who's like 15 years into a company, knows the company better than anybody else, but like has such a strong, I can't create, I'm not a creative, that she's like, okay, she's just giving up. Like, I'm not going to try.
Wow.
And there it is.
Yeah.
Right? And that is literally, literally standing in the way of her livelihood. So she's like, yeah, I guess I'm going to have to change companies and see if I can get the job someplace else with my experience.
Right. Just like doing the thing, whatever I'm supposed to do without where I can avoid being creative because I can't. Oh, geez. I mean, this is so, it's such those wounds are so amazing, right? Because they like, it's, you know, like the one that happened with me was like such a, you know, someone was actually trying to lift me up and it was like hard, you know? And what's interesting, one of the themes that's kind of been throughout this conversation is this idea of like mentorship and that there is this way that, but I'm also thinking about just the way you've been like collaborating in music, that it's also kind of this form of mentorship, you know, and that or being a director or just like the mutually sharing songs at Thrive is like this kind of in the Thrive choir is like this kind of mentorship. But it's there's something about like telling someone like, I see you and I see what's brilliant in you. Like what that like what Andrew said to you back in the day of just like, wow, I see you really come alive here. And like being that mirror is a way to sort of help with that sort of healing that's possible. And I imagine that that's something that like, imagine like with your youth choir, you know, working with like teenagers, you know, like there's this way that you can catch them, you know, relatively early, like after the wound, but before they've like metastasized the art scar. Yeah. Like, so what are some of the things that you suggest as like you're trying to help people either release their own creativity or like, you know, touch other people with that?
Yeah, thank you for that question and that reflection. I had the distinct pleasure of saying to Andrew Garrod, who I think is now in his mid-80s, that I have been paying forward that gift that he gave me as much as I can, working with young people, because the gift of being seen in a way that maybe is, you know, extra vulnerable, because singing is so vulnerable. You know, and I've been trying to pay that forward as often as I can, as much as I can, as deeply as I can. And so one of the ways that I try to do that is, to the extent possible, removing can't from the vocabulary. So it's like, Austin, I can't sing that note. It's like, are you comfortable saying that you haven't hit it yet? Okay, fine, I haven't hit it yet, right? And 9 times out of 10 over the past 23 years, people who are, you know, saying that they can't hit this note, it's because they're saying that they can't hit it and they're scared and they're not using the proper technique that they can't. And once they can release and surrender to the fact that they can keep trying and get there, they get there. So as something, it's so basic, and it basically comes down to the, like, I am my own worst enemy. No one will be able to criticize me more harshly than I will criticize myself. And when it comes explicitly to singing, it will literally block my voice. Because I say, oh, I'm so afraid of hearing how horrible I will sound if I'm sharp, if I'm flat, if my voice cracks, if it sounds shrill, that my voice shuts me down from being able to do it. And my body just says, no, I can't. And it's self-protective. And the challenge is that if we're trying to build anything resilient relationally, then we have to be vulnerable. And so there's only so far that self-protection takes us. And so the way that I try to support the youth that I work with is with that in mind. Like, there's a certain amount of support, and then there's a certain amount of vulnerability and risk that people have to take to keep growing. Because if I am in my comfort zone, I never grow. There's nothing new. There's nothing to learn.
Yeah, just like cultivating resiliency. And I love how this, like, you know, like, weaves back all the way through to, you know, some of the things we were talking about at the beginning about, you know, it's like doing the work, you know, also, and just like, and earning it, is it's like somehow communicating, like, so you haven't hit it yet. Like, that's in a way, like, encapsulated in that is this lesson of like, and like, you can actually do this, take the effort to like get there, and then you will have earned it. And then it'll be yours.
Exactly.
And that's going to be like so much more powerful than if you had just, you know, naturally just came out of the womb hitting that note, you know, or something.
Yeah. No, totally true. Totally true. You know, and around building resiliency, I mean, with Tilt On, the teen group that I work with, prior to quarantine, we took 3 retreats a year. So we'd go in the winter, we'd go in the summer, and we'd go in the spring. And on these retreats, in addition to like games and people staying up late and all that, there's also a bunch of time that's set aside for like really deep, slow check-ins. And then, you know, other sessions that are around whatever I am hearing from people's, you know, check-ins that seems like a theme that we really need to explore, whatever is super alive in the world that needs to be explored. And so, you know, over the years, a number of years ago, like we had a retreat that was dedicated to Black Lives Matter and really unpacking that. We've spent time deeply exploring social identity versus personal identity and the distinctions between those. We also spent some time in a really deep dive around gender.
Mm-hmm.
And for the past, I don't know, month and a half, 2 months, I've been facilitating conversations about systemic anti-Black racism, white fragility, white supremacy, all of these things. And one of the things that I think is so beautiful is that everybody in the group, and the group ranges in age from 14 to 18, are getting more comfortable in these conversations because they're getting to practice being in conversation about it. Mm-hmm. And so like the first time that I said it feels really important to do this, like some people are like, oh, like I don't want to say the wrong thing, right?
Right.
And we are so far past the I don't want to say the wrong thing, because people have been inspired and are doing their own research. So the conversations continue to grow. And that's like another way of encourage, like providing enough support and also encouraging the vulnerability that is a necessity for growth.
Hmm. I really want to lift that up too. Just like this, like the vulnerability is like this necessary part of growth. And maybe that's another answer to the question of like why music is so powerful and such a good bridge, because it's a way for us to interact with something that's like very tender and vulnerable and very profound in our heart, but like in a way that's relatively safe, right? You know, so you can like listen to a song and you can have your tears about it. You can sing along and just like know that you're there, but like, I didn't say those words, so I can still express this, you know, like, so there's something about that. It's really neat. Well, so Austin, there's a question I ask everyone who comes on the show here. And, and so, you know, based on your life experience, as we've heard, like what is something that you might invite people to pay attention to as they're trying to make a better life for themselves and the rest of the world?
I invite people to, in whatever way they can, create space for what James Taylor, in an interview I read a few years ago, referred to as having long, slow thoughts. Because if I am able to actually disengage from my phone, disengage from my laptop, disengage from Zoom, I hear and see everything around me differently. And I also hear and see myself differently. And given the extent to which the world is recognizing the need for some degree of reinvention, affording myself, and I believe affording ourselves that same space is one of the best things that we can be doing right now.
Mm. Wow, I really like that a lot. One of the episodes that's kind of hasn't come out yet, but will come out before this one, is with this guy named David Brubaker, and we talk about leading in an age of polarization. Mm. And he's done like a lot of deep research on how polarization works, and it's, you know, obviously really appropriate. And I'll just keep saying this. One of the take home, you know, as to be a leader in this is something you kind of said at the beginning, which is recognize your own dignity, recognize the dignity mm-hmm. of other people, mm-hmm. speak your truth, have your opinion, and then stay connected, you know, so hold that space for all sides. But one of the things that we talked about is like, just like when you're in an argument in a relationship, like one of the best things to do is like, let's take a break and like, let's let ourselves calm down a little bit here. And we're talking about how collectively we kind of need to take a pause. Mm-hmm. And I love this way that James Taylor has kind of framed it, you know, as like long, slow thoughts. Like, mm-hmm. can we use this opportunity in the world right now to just take like a, just slow down a minute and just yeah. like not try to just figure out whatever the next thing is, and instead just like slow down.
Yeah. Different possibilities will reveal themselves under those circumstances.
Exactly.
You know, and yeah. I discovered that with my own writing process. Like if I take my phone with me to the room where I'm doing some writing and trying to just vibe, I take it because there's a voice memo on it, which is an incredibly powerful and useful tool for me as a songwriter. I can capture the idea as it happens without trying to remember that cool thing that I did, right? Like I recorded it. But the challenge is, unless I put my phone in airplane mode and make sure that there are no reminders that come up about a birthday or another to-do, mm-hmm. then my focus is infinitely interruptible.
Yeah.
And so that tool also becomes a real liability.
Yeah, that's so real. And I think I heard somewhere else where someone was talking about just like, you know, like the creativity or just getting into flow. You need a good chunk of time to do that, you know.
Like, absolutely.
And if you are getting interrupted every 10 minutes or 15 minutes or 20 minutes or half hour, like you're actually not really able to like come up with anything new because right. your brain's going to reset. So this is so good. Thank you, Austin. I really appreciate this conversation. It feels like it's
well,
good
too.
Medicine.
Thank you for having me, Duncan.
Yeah. If people want to find you or want to listen to you or, you know, where can they do that?
AustinWillisey.com is my website. I have 4 albums on iTunes. I'm on Spotify and Thrive Choir, you'll be able to find the video on YouTube and on Facebook. House Jacks have 10 albums on iTunes and are also on Spotify.
Awesome. And of course, people can come to fractalfriends.us and
yes.
find the episode here. And we're going to have the bazillion links to different artists, and a lot of the artists we talked about in this episode, we'll have some links to them as well. So, Austin, thank you so much for this conversation.
Such a pleasure, Duncan. Thank you.
Thank you again for listening to this episode of Fractal Friends with Austin Willisey. You can find more content and links and resources and all that good stuff at fractalfriends.us. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter so you can get updates on new episodes and learn more about my work as the Chief Transformation Officer at Spoke and Wheel. Also, please consider donating to Fractal Friends. A small or large contribution really helps make this project of Fractal Friends sustainable. You can find buttons to donate at the website. You can learn more about Austin at austinwillisey.com, and you can learn more about my work at spokeandwheel.co. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to share it with someone. Text it to a friend, put it on Facebook, put it on Instagram, whatever you want to do. I am doing my part to amplify these voices, and I would love to have your support in spreading the word. And as usual, I'm going to close this out with a song. The song I'm going to share with you is by Austin Willisey and Patricia Bahia. and the lyrics are inspired by Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi. This is a song that Austin and I discuss in this episode. Please enjoy now. We are one love. Thank you for listening to Fractal Friends, and remember, we all have a role to play in the whole. Have a nice day.
No walls between our hearts, and no walls between our souls. Where you begin and where I start.